Hey, welcome back to the Mark Mosey Show. And joining me right now here on the phone line, talk all things NBA's. The second half will kick off this evening. Good friend of mine, it's Dan Favalli, the Bleacher Report, does a great job covering the NBA. Dan, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Let's start with the obvious. Did you enjoy the All-Star weekend?
I did. I thought, you know, the dunk contest was awesome on Saturday night. The three-point contest is always fun to watch. And the game itself, just looking at how the players played in the second half, that's one of the most competitive All-Star games I've ever seen, if not the single most competitive one. So I don't know whether it's a matter of the actual change to the Elam scoring model or whether it was more so to honor Kobe Bryant's work ethic, but the game itself was, particularly in the second half and that fourth quarter, was highly entertaining.
Okay, so moving forward, do you believe they should stay with that format for the fourth quarter?
I absolutely do. If you could just figure out how to make sure that the game can't end on free throws, I know that they've kicked around a bunch of ideas for that. It's definitely at least worth another shot because of how competitive this game itself was. You know, you had Kyle Lowry taking charges. You had guys defending, LeBron barking at the referees. There was just a lot of, I don't want to say playoff level intensity because I feel like that waters down the importance of the postseason, but there was definitely a certain, you know, maybe late regular season game crunch time intensity to how these guys were approaching it.
Here's what was interesting for me. It's like they constantly say the center position is dead. There's no more posting up. It's all shoot from outside. You notice in that fourth quarter, it was, let's get the ball to Embiid on every possession. You notice that, right?
Yeah, I mean, part of that, though, was just a lack of optionality. Giannis built one of the most poorly constructed rosters I've seen in the All-Star game, so there was definitely an element to it.
He put together an East Coast team. You know that, right?
Well, he didn't take, like, you know, some of those guys, if Embiid stays healthy, he'll obviously go to the Hall of Fame. But there was, at one point, I think it was in the fourth quarter, the Team LeBron just subbed in LeBron, Anthony Davis, Kawhi, and James Harden at the same time, which had to be the most terrifying single substitution in NBA history. You just had four Hall of Famers, most of them in their prime. It was just looking at that compared to Giannis's roster where you had DeMantis Sabonis, who's a good player. He was an All-Star, but he's not a future Hall of Famer. You have him on the floor for parts of the fourth quarter. It was just sort of like a sobering moment to look at that and be like, oh, wow, Team LeBron is definitely more talented than Team Giannis.
We had Kawhi Leonard win the MVP with 30 points, and he went crazy from the outside. If Kawhi wants, is he the best player on the planet, especially like when you see that All-Star game?
I still think there's the argument that he needs to be a better playmaker, even though he's been running a ton of pick and rolls this year. He's just not on the level of a LeBron necessarily, and that's what I think creates so much value. It's not just the scoring, but the ability to create so many shots for your teammates. That being said, if you were to say one game, maybe even one playoff series, and you can just be sure that he's going to play, there's definitely a case to be made there for him. He even said it, I think, after the All-Star game, is that he wanted that first inaugural Kobe Bryant MVP award, and so he just went out there and got it. And that's just how it feels so often when he's on the court, ever since he won his first Finals MVP, is that he can bend the game to his will when he's healthy and when he wants to.
We're here at Dan Favalli with the Bleacher Report. Back to the dunk contest. Is Aaron Gordon not winning, does that make him more famous? Like, did he get more publicity because he did not win the dunk contest?
Probably comparable publicity, just because I don't know how many people are going to just remember that Derek Jones Jr. was the one who upset him. Look, it was such an awkward situation. I guess there is, if you want to argue that Derek Jones Jr. had the better collection of dunks, that's probably fair. But if you look at what happened toward the end, where they gave his dunk over Taco Fall a 47 relative to what they gave some of the other dunks throughout the contest, there was just no rhyme or reason to that logic. And I think the fact that this was the second time he's been upset, yeah, that probably adds to the notoriety in a way that winning it wouldn't have. Because if you would have said that Aaron Gordon won two or three dunk contests, you know, that's cool. But you look at him and you might expect that. But the fact that he's 0-3 in dunk contests is just incredible.
It really is. The one, and I've said this all week, the one where, forget Taco Fall dunk, the one where it's like Markelle Fultz is on the side and he throws it off the side of the backboard, and Aaron Gordon just like grabs it and does a 360 dunk. That was the most insane dunk I saw that night. I'm sorry, man. That's my pick.
Yeah, that was definitely my favorite dunk of the night. I mean, the Taco Fall one stands out to me just because it was like completely improv. That Taco Fall had no idea that it was going to happen. No one predicted that was going to go into the into the overtime of the dunk contest, whatever you want to call it. But that had to be the best dunk of the night, is the one, the 360 off the side of the backboard.
It is insane. And you're right. Like, you're improvising. So he's probably never dunked over Taco Fall. And he's like, ah, sure, let's go for it. Let's. It's so crazy.
Taco Fall is almost 7.5 feet tall, and he basically cleared him. I know there was some contact, but he basically cleared him. And they gave it a 47. And meanwhile, they gave Dwight Howard a 49, probably because he put Kobe Bryant's number on his chest for that just plain old Superman dunk.
Wait a minute. Didn't Nate Robinson, didn't he jump over Dwight Howard to win a dunk contest? And then it's like, oh, you dunked over Taco Fall, whatever. Is that what it's come to in the dunk contest?
I mean, Taco Fall has 8 inches on Dwight Howard.
I know.
On Dwight Howard. So I don't think it should come down to that. That whole thing, I know Dwayne Wade wasn't the only judge who gave him a 9. There were two others that did. At the same time, the NBA probably could have avoided a little bit of a controversy by looking at the judge panel and saying, oh, you know, D-Wade played with Derrick Jones Jr. last year. Maybe we should avoid any potential heat bias and pick another judge or just something like that.
I hope you know, Magic fans, they really hate that it was the Heat that screwed him over in the dunk contest. I hope you know that.
Well, yeah, and again, it's just salt in the wound because now this is, the third dunk contest Aaron Gordon loses, the second time he makes it to the finals and arguably had the better dunks and he still loses, that has to hurt. And then on top of it, to see him get so oddly scored on what was one of the three best dunks of the night, I would say, when he dunked over Taco Fall, and then for it to be by a Miami Heat guy and for Dwayne Wade to be one of the players that didn't give him a 10, just a perfect storm of just terrible circumstances for them.
Okay, let's go to the Eastern Conference. As we were saying, second half of the season starts tonight. Are the Milwaukee Bucks, are they the clear-cut favorite in the Eastern Conference now?
Yeah, I think they are. There is definitely an element of the East being wide open. I think that the Raptors or the Celtics could really give them a series, depending on what version of the Sixers you get, the one at home or the one on the road. They're a team to watch. But the Bucks are very clearly a tier over everybody else. They've been destroying opponents when Giannis Antetokounmpo is off the floor. They've leaned into more Giannis Antetokounmpo lineups at center, and those combinations are killing opponents as well. We probably tend to overestimate the impact that buyout signings will have, but Marvin Williams effectively allows them to play small without giving up too much size, because you just look at lineups where him and Giannis would be the front court. That's an upgrade over whatever minute you were going to give to DJ Wilson or Robin Lopez, in my opinion. So they're just a team that can come at you from basically everywhere. The thing that you still have to question is, will they have enough secondary shot creation in the half court? Should teams be able to keep Antetokounmpo away from the rim like the Raptors did in the conference finals last year? And, that's a real question. But when you look at how Eric Bledsoe has played, how Chris Middleton has played, even the secondary playmaking that you've gotten from Dante DiVincenzo this year, it does feel like the Bucks are better suited to roll through the East than they were last season.
The Boston Celtics had a nice win over the Clippers before the break. Are they starting to click as a team and maybe be a contender in the East?
Yeah, they're right there. It's helped that Jason Tatum's been volcanic over the past couple weeks. Pretty much ever since it was announced that he was going to the All-Star game, he's been absolutely molten. And Gordon Hayward's been playing really well. Jaylen Brown's had an overall solid season. The concerns for them is their bench. They're not particularly deep, and who's going to be that reserve scorer? Those minutes aren't as important necessarily in the playoffs because you're going to play your starters a bunch more, and you have Marcus Smart. At the same time, you can still lose the series based on the minutes where your best players aren't together. We saw it with Philly last year and when Joel Embiid was off the court. I'm worried about their lack of size as much as others. I think Daniel Tice is good enough. They've been better defensively than I expected with Enes Kanter on the floor, and I'm also a big fan of Grant Williams playing the five as well. So it does seem like they might have the depth up front specifically, but just their bench in general, and then I think you have to get into the discussion that there's a chance they may not have the best player in any given series. They definitely won't have it against the Bucks. If you go against the Sixers, you might not have it. The Heat have Jimmy Butler, so you might not have the best player in that series. Even the Raptors with Pascal Siakam. So that's sort of the issue they get into. And it does feel like at times these teams need that top five or top 10 guy, and they don't quite have that yet, though both Kemba Walker and Jason Tatum are certainly good alternatives to that.
Philadelphia, are they an actually good basketball team? Because I don't know.
I think they're good, and I think that you could put them in a series against any team in the East, including the Bucks, and there's a scenario in which they would win. The bigger problem with them is it seems that they could also lose almost any series. If you go up against the Celtics or the Raptors or the Heat, it doesn't feel like they're given to win those series, let alone a matchup with the Bucks. And they've moved Al Horford to the bench. That should help. But what do you do in the postseason when Joel Embiid's probably going to play between 35 and 38 minutes a game? Do you not have Horford on the court with him at all, in which case he's only playing 10 to 15 minutes every night? Are you going to close with all five of your top guys, or are you going to put Matisse Thybulle in there, maybe Furkan Korkmaz instead of in Al Horford? They just have a lot of questions, and their offense can be really uneven for stretches at a time. And so they are a good team, but I do believe that the ship has sailed on them with this exact core being a great team.
The Miami Heat, who we were talking about before, we're here at Dan Vivelli at the Bleacher Report. Are they a contender? Like, is this a realistic team in the East now?
I'd probably put them in the Boston Celtics tier where, you know, I have Milwaukee in the first tier. I think you could probably argue that Toronto might be in a tier of its own at this point, and that the Heat are sort of closer to the Celtics than genuine contention, where it still feels like maybe they're a piece short. That Andre Iguodala trade helps them if he's going to be able to defend at a semi-high level. Jay Crowder, it's only been three games for him in Miami, but he's been shooting the heck out of the ball since he got there, and that's big because he really gives you some defensive optionality on bigger wings. It's just that his three ball really hasn't been falling over the past couple seasons, and so if you get consistent shooting from him, it really opens up your offense. They've been super efficient offensively this year. I do wonder if that will translate to the playoffs. You're going to need Andre Iguodala and Goran Dragic to really provide that secondary shot creation to ensure that you don't run into those issues that you see other teams, even with Giannis sometimes, where it seems like they need another creator in the postseason crucible. But overall, though, they've been, you know, basically a top 10 team at both ends of the floor. And then after getting deeper at the trade deadline, they traded a lot of dead minutes because Justice Winslow was injured for guys, at least two of them, who actually factor into their rotation. So I think you put them right there in the East where, yes, there's a scenario in which they come out of the conference. You don't necessarily expect them to win it, but it's certainly possible.
Okay, we're here at Dan Vivelli at the Bleacher Report. Let's go to the Western Conference. Right now, who's the best team in the Western Conference?
I still think it's the Lakers. If we go into a playoff series, I can understand why people would favor the Clippers, but they've been so banged up. And they have some interesting crunch time lineup decisions to make. Do you play Harold? Do you go with Jermichael Green at the five? Marcus Morris seems like a good fit for them, but now you've added another ball stopper in addition to Kyrie Irving and Paul George, who are good playmakers, but that's not their first instinct. And it's the same story with Lou Williams. So you're kind of wondering if they've gotten too far into the secondary creator roles or the score first guys. Could that come back to bite them? I still think the Nuggets are probably underrated. They've really perked up over the past couple months, and when they're fully healthy, and if Michael Porter Jr. continues to play the way that he has, they're going to be a lot more dangerous than people give them credit for. So there are teams, they all seem like a neck and neck, but just looking at the body of work in the regular season, I could see people favoring the Clippers in a series with the Lakers, but I think that's the only team that has a case to be concretely better than LeBron's team right now.
The Mavericks are going to play the Magic on Friday night. It's the first time we're going to get a chance to see Luka up front. Are the Mavericks good? Like, is that a team that's going to make the playoffs and maybe do some damage because of Luka?
They're definitely locked in just because of the distance between them and the 9 and 10 seeds in the Western Conference, so they're set there. It did look like they were going to be able to do some damage earlier on in the season. It really all depends on how healthy Luka Doncic is and whether they can get more out of the minutes when Dinsky and Kristaps Porzingis are on the floor. They're handily winning the minutes when Doncic plays without Kristaps, and they're also handily winning the minutes when Porzingis plays without Luka. But you put those two together, and they're still a net plus, but they're not as demonstrative a net plus. And the defense isn't necessarily as good as you would expect it to be, you know, for the offense. It gets a little bit hairier, too, because you lost Dwight Powell for the year. So how do you run that front court rotation around Kristaps Porzingis? Do you just view him as a five now? Can you play him with Willie Cauley-Stein, who defends fours in that situation? Do you have to lean too heavily on Maxi Kleber? So there are a lot of factors that go into that. But when you just look at the way Luka Doncic has played this year and the manner in which he elevates those around him, you also, I think, have to factor in that Tim Hardaway Jr.'s had a fantastic year, that the Mavericks are still deeper than probably advertised. I wouldn't want to face them in a first-round series. And so, you know, if you're the Clippers or the Nuggets and you have to face them in the first round, you're probably favored, but I don't think it's a guaranteed advancement by any stretch.
Okay. This is the tough one. I'll put you on the spot. Who's better, Utah or Denver?
It's Denver to me, and Utah, look, if Mike Conley continues to click the way that he sort of was leading into the All-Star break, that'll be huge for them. But Rudy Gobert, I don't think that he's as schemable as people joke about. You know, the whole thing with the Rockets last postseason, after the first two games, Rudy Gobert actually was able to stay on the floor and played really well for the rest of that series. It's just that going up against Nikola Jokic, he can do so many things that Rudy Gobert isn't used to defending. And I don't think that necessarily neutralizes Gobert's defense, but it certainly minimizes the effect of it. And that's what really sells it for me. You can certainly argue that Utah maybe has the most talented number one scorer because Jokic's first instinct isn't to score, and Jamal Murray is inferior to Donovan Mitchell. But when you look at what Michael Porter Jr. has done, when you look at the season that Will Barton has had, when you look at what they can do with a healthy Paul Millsap, I still think that team, it would be a close series, but I think that they're better overall.
All right, let's go over your awards so far. MVP, who do you like right now?
It's Giannis in a landslide, and I think the only other player worth considering is LeBron, but even he just falls short compared to what Antetokounmpo is doing for Milwaukee.
If Milwaukee doesn't have Giannis, are they one of the worst teams in the NBA?
No. They've been straight annihilating opponents without him on the court, and how sustainable that is over a longer haul is questionable, but we also have to factor in that the sample size without him isn't small. They're, I believe, 4-1 when he doesn't play this year, and he's only averaging 31 minutes a game, not even. So you're going, you know, 16, 17, 20 minutes a game without him playing sometimes, and you're winning those minutes. That's a huge deal. And so I think the Bucks, you know, If you're looking at it in hindsight, yes, they absolutely should have paid the tax and kept Malcolm Brogdon.
Yeah.
But they're somehow still better than they were last year and probably deeper than they were. So they're a scary team.
Who is rookie of the year right now?
It's Ja Morant. And there's really, look, Zion's been fantastic, but I just don't know. He missed basically half the season. I just don't know how you can feasibly come back from that. Unless Ja Morant falls off a cliff the rest of the year, the Memphis Grizzlies, as of right now, would make the playoffs and are over 500. And just no one could have predicted that. So if Zion were healthy the entire season, he probably wins it. But I think you still have to go with John Moran right now.
If the Pelicans get Zion for 82 games, are they a contender in the Western Conference next year?
They need to add at least one more piece, probably in free agency. They would definitely be a playoff team to me if you're going to guarantee me that Zion Williamson remains healthy. But their wing depth is sort of weird. Like, they have Brandon Ingram, but then their second best wings are really undersized. Like, if it's Josh Hart or if it's an H1 Moore. And so they need guys who can soak up those minutes. And you could probably also argue that their center position is a little bit in flux. Derek Favors has been great for them, but will they resign him and can he stay healthy? Will Jackson Hayes be able to foul a little bit less and blow fewer assignments? Those are all things that they need to improve upon. But if you can say that Zion Williamson is healthy next year, they have an obvious path to the playoffs. And I would say, you know, I wouldn't call them a contender, but if you said they were going to be fifth, maybe even fourth in the West, I don't think it would be too much of a farce.
Can we give Damian Lillard some, like, special award for just being an unstoppable scorer for the last, like, couple weeks? Can we do that?
Yes, we can call him something about effort in futility because it doesn't look like the Blazers are going to make the playoffs. I mean, they have a chance. They're only five losses back at the Grizzlies, and Memphis has the hardest remaining schedule.
Mm-hmm.
But Damian Lillard,
just been absolutely on fire and torrid. It'll be interesting to see how the Blazers do while he navigates this groin injury, because they can't afford, never mind, you know, 2 weeks, they can't afford to lose him for two games.
If he played on the New York Knicks, how big of a star would Damian Lillard be?
He would probably be more frequently mentioned in the MVP conversation and would be a more universally accepted top 10 player.
Uh-huh.
I think the key would be if he were on a team like that and he leads the Knicks to the playoffs where the roster around him isn't necessarily deep or all that impressive, that's how you just become like legendary, because everyone tends to be overrated in New York. Kristaps Porzingis was like dubbed this top 25 player before he ever really earned that billion. So you put an actual superstar in New York like Damian Lillard, and there would be cases coming out of the woodwork for him to be one of the five best players in the game.
Let's end with this. How did the Cavaliers and the Warriors become the two worst teams in the NBA after they went to four straight finals together in the past 5 years?
Yeah, Cleveland is more easy to understand just because they built their entire team around LeBron James, and it was becoming this difficult task to reach the finals even with him. So he leaves, and you're stuck. Like, you had already traded Kyrie Irving, then you go and extend Kevin Love for some reason. That was sort of predictable, this bottoming out. The Warriors, injuries have contributed to it, and so has Kevin Durant's departure, but they just became so shallow near the end of that run, where they have the talent where Durant's departure, as weird as it sounds, should not have crippled them. And yet, they gave up Andre Iguodala to the Grizzlies to bring in D'Angelo Russell, and at the beginning of the year when Steph was healthy, they were not good. They were terrible. And so, yes, they didn't have Klay Thompson, but how much better would he make you in the West? Given full strength, maybe they contend for a playoff spot this year, and I was definitely higher on them than a lot of people entering the season. But unless Wiggins really just explodes there, or they're able to turn that Minnesota pick, their own pick, and then Wiggins being the salary filler into a high-impact player, maybe a couple of impact players, I just don't see the path back to title contention being as clear or unobstructed for them. I think they could do it, and I probably remain a little bit higher on their outlook than the consensus, but I think this season has proved, even before the injuries, that their run, they were just kind of on fumes with their depth, and you could start to tell in that NBA Finals, and then just between losing Durant, Andre Iguodala, Sean Livingston retiring, and just all those things, it's really starting to show some cracks in their foundation.
Okay, so the dream scenario is they get the first pick, okay, and then you add Andrew Wiggins, you get Klay back and Steph back, you have Draymond there. Do you draft a big, a point guard? What do you do if you're the Warriors?
I honestly have no idea. This doesn't seem like a draft where there's going to be a consensus pick, regardless of who's at number one or even just necessarily in the top three. I feel like you could see it going the way of Anthony Edwards. Could it be a James Wiseman? Could it be, some people think that it might even be LaMelo Ball. So there's a ton of different directions to go. If it were the Warriors, my guess would be that they go with an Anthony Edwards just to sort of continue adding wings. You know, someone who's 6'5 and can play the two or the three spot. He's been pretty inefficient this year. I'm not this college basketball aficionado, so I'm just watching it 10 steps removed. Maybe that's an issue, but that, if they were the number one pick right now, that's who I would expect them to select.
His name's Dan Vivalli with the Bleacher Report. Does a great job covering the NBA. Dan, my man, thank you so much for your help, and have a great day, all right?
No problem. Thanks for having me, Mark.